just did it purely by email. So didn't advertise it, didn't market it. So built our own crowdfunding platform to do it and raised just a little bit over 350 grand in 24 hours. I'm a big believer that ordinary people do extraordinary things or can do extraordinary things. So that would be my advice to people out there. If you're interested in trying this thing, that you don't have to be, you don't need to be super intelligent or anything like that. You just need the desire and the enough knowledge to be able to make it happen. I think desire gets you a long way.
It takes courage and belief in yourself and your business idea to take the step to set up your own business. In the early stages, entrepreneurship can be a lonely road, even through those milestone moments. Deciding to commit to the idea you've been mulling over, learning, growing, and developing your skills, building a team to help you along the way, preparing to launch into new markets. Enterprise Ireland is there for all of those startup moments. From providing advice and guidance to new founders through our startup network, to pre-seed funding and early investment, we're here to help bring your ambition to fruition. To find out how Enterprise Ireland can help you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Hey, quick heads up. If you're still in Windows 10, you need to know it's going out of support this October. That means no updates, no patches, just risk. Nostra can help. They're offering free upgrade consultations for businesses right now. Hit the link in the episode description. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to share a game changer for your business, Azure Communications. When it comes to print and marketing solutions, these folks, led by CEO Jenny Johnston, are the real deal. Whether you need an eye-catching brochure, sleek business cards, or a full-blown digital campaign, Azure Communications has you covered. They're not just about high-quality prints or digital campaigns, they're also about delivering great results. And here's the best part. Just for listeners of The Entrepreneur Experiment, you can get 20% off your first order. Just give them a call or go online and use the code VOX20. With personalized service and fast turnaround times, Azure Communications will help you make the impact your business deserves. Trust me, when it comes to making your brand stand out, Azure Communications is the provider of choice. Check them out at azurecom.ie. Use code VOX20 and elevate your marketing game today. Dean, welcome to the pod.
Gary, thanks for having me on. Delighted to be here.
And I was learning all about what Vegemite is.
It's an acquired taste, Gary. It's an acquired taste. I think if you're from Australia, you're kind of raised on it. So yeah, I wouldn't say it's for everybody.
Okay. Australia to Carlow. That's quite the trip.
Yeah, Australia to Kildare, really. My wife's from Newbridge.
Okay.
So we moved over here about 2009. So I was the guy that got off the plane and when everything crashed and was literally getting off going, geez, what happened to you guys? It was all going so well here before when we decided
maybe it was
to move
you.
Over.
Maybe you brought it with you.
Yeah, maybe. So yeah, so 2009 we moved over. My wife's from Newbridge. So yeah, we live just outside of Nace now. I've been there for about 15 years.
Where were you before?
I lived in Brisbane. So yeah, Brisbane down in Oz. So very different climate and environment to here. People are very similar, but yeah, the weather is quite different. Took a while to adjust to that, I must say.
I would imagine. Mm. What brought you home?
To here? Mm. My wife. So yeah, so her, it's a long story. Her dad was unwell at the time. I had a business down in Australia that we just sold, just exited out of. And
what was that?
In golf, so golf distribution. So we had a couple of domestic brands down there and also distributed, managed a couple of American brands for the Australian market. And a Japanese company bought out one of the brands we dealt with globally and they bought out my business in Australia.
Okay.
So, yeah, ran out of excuses to stay, basically. My wife was keen to get back and so we came back. And then once the kids, I've got three daughters, so once they started school and kind of got in the swing of it, I'm a lifer. We're here for good, I think.
What was it like coming over? Because I think in Ireland we kind of overlook the challenges maybe of what it's like coming into Ireland.
Yeah, it's funny. My old flatmate at the time is an Aussie fellow, obviously. He married an English girl. So he moved over here, he lives in Worcester now, and moved over quite a few years before I did. When we first got married, we lived in Oz for about 6 or 7 years. And when I told him I was moving over, he goes, Dino, you'll be right, mate. It just takes about 7 years to settle in. And I laughed. I thought he was joking. And honestly, almost to the day of 7 years, it was like, okay, yeah, he was right. But it's, as I mentioned before, it's really, it's the lifestyle more than anything. So from Brisbane, it's kind of subtropical. So if we were going to do anything, you don't have to worry about the weather. So if you want to go and have a barbecue or you want to go and play golf or you want to go to the beach or whatever, you can do that and plan that for the following day or the weekend or whatever that might be. Whereas here, it's very changeable. So it took a little while to get used to having to put three coats on and a beanie to go outside in winter.
And then 10 minutes later, it's roasting.
Yeah, well, particularly with the three kids, it was like, have you got your scarf? Have you got your gloves? Have you got your
and sunscreen?
Yeah, and so anyway, but look, once you get used to it and get into the swing of it, it's been fantastic, and I certainly wouldn't.
How do the kids adjust?
Kids were fine. So two were born in Australia, one was born here. Okay. So one was three, I think, when we came across. So they barely remember. They can do the accent. They have a great fun throwing off at me.
Okay.
But yeah, they're Irish essentially. So.
And then when you came over, what were you thinking you were going to do? Were you thinking I'll get back in the golf or what?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question actually. So because of the business we had in Oz, it could probably grown to be the largest independent distributor or golf business in the country down there, and we weren't that old at the time, so you kind of think you're the master of the universe and got it all sussed out, but you forget very quickly. We probably worked in the industry down there for nearly 20 years, so you forget the level of connections and contacts that you develop over that period of time, and just what's that worth to you for whatever your next venture might be. And coming across to Ireland, obviously Ireland's a small market, so I knew we had to do something beyond or outside the borders of Ireland, so I looked to the UK as well, and really tried to do the same thing. So set up a couple of my own brands, or one of my own brands, and distribute for a couple of American brands. But discovered very quickly that when I got here that no one knew you from Adam, and you were really starting from zero again. So that was a bit of a reality check to have to go from having all these connections and pretty much being able to get any major retailer that you wanted to talk to on the phone and say, hey, I've got this particular product, you know, I think you should stock it, here's Y, X, Y, Z, and they generally go with your
They trust you, they know you, you've built up the network. So you had all the knowledge, but none of the network.
Correct. And then you kind of ring these people and you can barely get a time to see them, and they barely take your calls, and it was tough there for a few years. It wasn't great fun.
Mm.
But anyway, then that kind of causes you to rethink what you want to do. And I was very fortunate. I started working with I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's not specifically a golf brand, but it's a sort of a luggage brand called OGIO, American company that they're big into motorsports, dirt bikes, that type of stuff, and make really fancy, unusual luggage. And they were getting into golf. And because I'd exited in Australia, they were looking to build their business globally to exit as well. Excuse me. So they approached me to develop their distribution for Ireland and the UK within golf. As part of the deal I signed with them, I negotiated to set up their online business for the EU, so all through Europe.
Okay.
And that was probably my second foray into online at the time. But I found that really interesting because we were selling more online than we were through the traditional B2B at the time. This is about 10 years ago. When we would take the product into the traditional retailer market, you would get pushback. Was like, no, it's a little bit unusual. It's a little bit too different. My membership's not going to buy that, or my customers aren't going to be interested.
And what was it? It was like luggage or golf specific storage bags.
So it was golf bags, but really bright colored, unusual materials and fabrics, and quite out there. It's good stuff. It's cool. But yeah, very different from the traditional golf stuff. So I just found it was interesting that the consumer was really open to new products and to different brands, but they just weren't getting to see that in a traditional retail environment. So to cut a long story short, so OGIO ended up selling to an American company called Callaway. So my contract with them finished at that time. And then it was like, well, what do we do next? And as I said, that was really when that idea of online and sort of digital transformation really sort of started to take hold. And the other thing I was seeing at the time within the golf industry, again, this is all pre-COVID. Golf's gone through a bit of a boom since COVID. But prior to that, you would see in the press, and you'd probably see in the press generally, that people would say, look, golf's in a bit of state of decline. You know, membership numbers are down, courses are closing, and it's not really going
there. Yeah, there was a narrative like that for a while. There was kind of like, oh, golf is going down. It's kind of an old sport. It's dying off. It's not cool anymore.
Yeah, definitely. That was definitely there. But the market reports I was getting when I was working with OGIO was that the number of rounds played, so how much people were playing golf, was starting to increase. And if you dug down a little bit deeper into that, you could see that it was starting to increase because three new demographics were coming to the game. So there was more women starting to play, more juniors, and it's a bit of a catch-all demographic, but more millennials. So there's more younger people coming into golf. Thought that was really interesting. So if you tie that with the whole digital transformation thing.
That's super interesting because the narrative, the data is ahead of the narrative.
Correct.
You were able to see the data and go, I think that narrative is off, because the mainstream media narrative can be quite funny at times. It can be a bit of an echo chamber.
You know,
one report is published, and then it's published everywhere without actually anyone going, let's just have a look.
Yeah, should we check the data on that?
Well, because like the journalism has shrunk so much that there's, you know, it used to be like a journalist to have like 2 days to work on a story. Now they have to do 10 a day.
Yeah.
So there was no one kind of digging in, and experts behind the scenes like yourself kind of going, right, let's just have a quick look. So you were able to look at the data and go, this trend, if it continues, would mean X. So what did you think it would mean?
Well, as I said, so there's two things going on there. So one is that the demographics are changing. So there's a new group of people coming into the market who buy or consume goods in general, not just golf, in a very different way to the traditional market would do that. You have the traditional retail market telling you that they only want certain brands and only want certain products, and they're not going to buy all this other stuff. Yet my experience was showing me actually people are actually open to new products and different products. They're just not getting to see it. So you kind of put those two things together. And that's really what was the genesis for the idea for Seed. So we call ourselves a digital native direct to consumer golf brand. And that was kind of the strategy behind it. That's how we put it together, which all sounds great. And it's a great business strategy.
It's a great line,
but then
I'm going to write it down.
But the next thing is, okay, once you come up with that little positioning statement, the next thing is, okay, we've got to make a product. What are we going to sell? And that was a bit of a challenge. So it was kind of like, okay, well, as I mentioned to you before, coming from Australia, it's not really, golf's not a seasonal sport down there. So you can play all year round, basically. So the weather's pretty good. You can get out all year round. So you don't have to worry about the variances in the weather. Whereas here, it's clearly seasonal, and there's a winter and there's a summer, and people play a lot of golf in summer, and they still play in winter, but they don't play as much as they would in the summer. So you kind of need I suppose what I'm driving at there is you kind of need a product that they can use all year round. So you're looking for a consumable type of product. And for us, that was golf balls. So people play through the winter here. That you're very hardy souls, and you will get out there and have a game. So they're still using golf balls. They're still losing golf balls, and they still will purchase them. But they're unlikely to, if we'd started a golf brand selling, you know, I don't know, golf drivers or golf irons or something like that, they're probably not going to buy those in winter.
It's a slower purchase as well. You're not buying them every year, every week. You're buying them like once every 5 years,
correct.
I imagine.
Yeah, I was just going to say the time for that is about once every 5 years. Might have shortened a little bit, but it's generally once every five.
Okay. So talk to me about the idea stage, because I'm actually fascinated by this, because everyone has a different story of how they started zero to one piece. This is the bit I'm always really digging into at Founders, because to try and inspire people who are listening who maybe have that idea. How did you come up with the idea for Seed? As in, you had the data, then you were like, I'm going to create a direct-to-consumer company, and now we'll create the product? Or what? Talk me through the process of that.
The brand came first, so it was very much the digital native direct-to-consumer golf brand. I think there's a market in vague terms
for
a new golf brand to emerge that talks specifically to those demographics I was talking about. And if you look at any of the Seed branding, the packaging is very different. We use recycled cardboard. You know, traditional brands would use high embossed gloss and all this sort of fancy stuff, and we kind of stripped it all back the other way. So we kind of were appealing to that demographic, really. The brand came first, and then it was like, okay, to set up a business around that brand, as I said, that's a good business strategy. But then it's like, okay, well, what do we do next? How do we actually make this work? And so the idea of a consumable came into play, and then the logical step for that was a golf ball. And again, great strategy. That makes perfect sense, Dean. That's all sounding great. But then you've got to design a golf ball that plays as well as all these billion-dollar companies. And that was really the next challenge. So that took a couple of years to put together.
Wow.
And our value proposition is really simple, and it's same performance for half the price. So that's what we started out trying to do, was can we develop a product that will play as well as whatever the market-leading brands are and get it to consumers for less money than what they're paying currently. And we think that's, if we can do that online, deliver it direct to them, to the door, that's a really sound business strategy that should work. So that was the basis for everything.
Thanks for breaking that down, because it kind of re-emphasizes what I talk about in the pod all the time, is there's no one way.
Definitely.
Everyone's like, oh, what's the one way? I was like, there's no one way. That's why I love what I do, because like every time you talk to a founder, it's different. Some people are like, I just had this burning idea for this product, couldn't get it out of my head. And some people like yourself go, right, let's work through the logic flow here. What does the data say? What could I create? What makes sense in the market? You know, the logical step by step. So like there's, and you have to go with what works for you. What's your personality? What are you driven by? Are you methodical? Are you not? Like that's brilliant. So 2 years developing a product.
Yeah.
The hell did you do for those 2 years? Because
developed a product.
But that's a long, how did you like sustain both yourself and the interest?
Okay, cool. There's one piece of the puzzle which I hadn't mentioned. So with the golf ball, being within the industry, what I also knew was that the golf ball is the most heavily regulated piece of equipment that a golfer would use in their golf bag, meaning that there's two governing bodies that regulate all the use of golf equipment in the world, and that's the RNA, the Royal and Ancient Golf Society for Europe, and the USGA, which is the United States Golf Association over in the States. So there's a like a performance line that golf balls can't go past. So it doesn't matter whether it's us or whether it's the leading golf ball brand. It can only come off the club face. It has to be a certain weight, certain shape, certain size, can only come off the club face at a certain speed, and can only travel so far through the air and total distance also. So as long as we could design up to that line, then that thing I mentioned about having, say, performance for half the price could actually be true. So the trick was trying to figure out, or almost reverse engineer, if you like, how can we get a golf ball that performs that well. I was very fortunate that Enterprise Island heard about the idea in the very early stages and picked it up and put us down at a university in the Midlands of Ireland in Carlow called SETU, which is now called SETU, where they had access for us for Department of Aerospace. So there was wind tunnels and that type of thing down there. They have a rapid prototyping lab called Design Core, which was able to do CAD design for us and 3D printing. So in theory, what we could do is CAD design a golf ball, 3D print it on campus, take it up to the wind tunnel and test it. There's another department down there called EngCore, which does a lot of the mechanical engineering around the construction of it. So very quickly, and as an Australian, I just rocked up to Carlo University, not a clue what was down there, and going, really? There's a wind tunnel in that next building and I can use that. That's amazing. So we were very lucky. So we basically spent 2 years within that university environment trying to figure out how we could manufacture or develop a prototype, firstly, that would play as well as those premium balls I was talking about, and then figure out the rest of it can be figured out after that. The product was the central piece of the puzzle at that stage. I was very fortunate. So I'd done a lot of product design and development in the past myself. So I had a reasonable reputation, I think, through Asia with those manufacturing partners. And that was another challenge was, okay, let's say we design this golf ball in Carlo. You've got to get it made somewhere, and there's no manufacturing within Ireland to make
high-performance
three-piece golf balls. It just doesn't exist. So you're going to have to use an industry leader to do that, and there's probably a handful of companies in the world that can manufacture to the standard that we needed. So if I just, I don't know, was Dean off the street and was trying to find those manufacturing partners, it was probably quite difficult. So it was literally a case of getting on a plane, flying to Taiwan, which is where the golf balls are made, rocking up to a few factories and manufacturing partners that I knew, and essentially almost like an investor pitch of pitching them, okay, this is my idea, pretty much what I just said to you. This is where I think the market's going. This is what I'm seeing. This is where I think it's going to be. This is what's happened. I think, like, it can sound as though I foresaw a lot of this happening, but I think it's important to understand that golf is a very conservative and traditional and slow-moving industry. So all the stuff I'm talking about, digital transformation, had happened in other industries like 5 years before. So stuff like BrewDog would have been a company we would have looked at closely when we were modeling ourselves on. That might seem unusual, but I think if you look at that industry where, certainly when I first came to Ireland, say 20 years ago, when I first started coming over here, you go into a pub and you can get Guinness and Heineken and maybe Budweiser and that's it. And you look at that and think, there's no way a craft brew company can crack that. And clearly they have.
That's a good analogy, yeah.
Yeah. And the other one was which is a people use all the time now, but at the time it was kind of relatively new, was Dollar Shave Club. And again, the idea that two brands, Gillette and Wilkinson Sword, had about 70 or 80% of the market share looks unassailable, but those guys figured out a way of getting in there and kind of disrupting that industry. And I looked at golf and thought, that's really interesting. The top two brands in golf control about 70% of market share.
What are the top two brands?
In the UK, it's Titleist and Strixon, Strixon is the company that bought us out in Australia. So I knew their business quite well. So I kind of thought, that's interesting market conditions. And there has been disruption, which is kind of a catch-all world at the moment, but there has been, you know, market changes, and there has been upstarts, challenger brands that have come in and made some inroads. So we kind of saw that as well and thought that that could happen with golf. So it was really about putting that together. So to give those manufacturing partners I mentioned up in Taiwan credit, like, they're smart business people, and they could probably look at it and go, okay, Dean's been pretty good to deal with over the years, and this sounds like a reasonable strategy he's put together here. Let's give him a try. And if I look back to how we got started, obviously dealing with those large manufacturing companies, there's massive minimum order quantities that you have to reach to do production runs of unique golf product and all that sort of stuff. And if I look back at how I convinced them to start with, there's a photo on our Instagram page somewhere. You'd have to go miles back down of the first pallet of golf balls we ever got in. And it's like half a pallet of golf balls. And I look back at that and think, geez, I have no idea how I convinced them to do that. But they did. And we like sold all that out straight away and then did it again. And it just grew from there.
It shows you, I think your story is a great example of the power network. You suffered Correct. When you didn't have it, but then you were able to tap back into it. And
well, it's still right. there. I just used it in a different way.
Yeah. What are golf balls made from?
A lot of plastics. It's not a very environmentally friendly product, to be honest. So it's yeah, rubbers and plastics, basically. Okay. A modern golf ball. It used to be like almost rubber bands wrapped around the inside of them, but that's all changed in the last 20 years. So yeah, rubbers and plastics.
So you've 2 years to develop the product.
Mm-hmm.
How do you maintain consistency, mindset, certainty over those 2 years? Because they're the hard... All the years are hard as a founder, but they're very troubling years because you don't have anything tangible to deal with, you know? How did you do that?
That's an interesting question. And I often look back and think, why would you do this to yourself? Why would you put yourself through 2 years of like pain like that to get that off the ground? And then that's only the start of it. You still got to launch it and get it to market and find customers and do all that stuff, which is really the next step. I don't know. I think I've always wanted to do my own thing. Might have a problem with authority. I don't know.
I share that affliction or blessing sometimes it depends.
So I always wanted to do my own thing and was I think I just really believed in it. I just could see, and maybe nobody else did. And I had a couple of people through the Enterprise Island Network say to me, are you just doing this because you can or because there's a genuine market need for that? Like a lot of guys at that level kind of didn't really see that we were doing anything that dramatically different to perhaps what was already gone there. And perhaps maybe like their big thing was, what problem are you solving? That was their kind of big thing they put to you. And I don't know that they necessarily saw that we were solving a particular problem at the time. But I don't know. For whatever reason, I just believed in it, thought that it was going to work. And sometimes you can get that sort of tunnel vision. And I didn't expect it would take 2 years, but once you're in and you're 6 months in, 12 months in, it's kind of like, well, geez, we're almost there now. We might as well keep going. You know what I mean? And then, 6 months becomes 2 years and here we are.
Because I think that's important for founders to hear, especially if they're in that journey now. I think it's really nice for them to hear people like you kind of going, yeah, it was 2 years, because there's a glamorization of entrepreneurship and founders that, you know, oh yeah, just start there hustling just all the time. A lot of it's quite boring. A lot of it's quite lonely and quite boring. It's in, you're sitting in a lab or you're sitting in an office by yourself oftentimes going, that self-doubt does creep in, going, am I doing anything different? Maybe they're right. Maybe I'm not.
They definitely, and I found it really an interesting process to go through, to be questioned, because it probably came from that thing I mentioned in Australia. Everything's spinning really well. Everything you're doing is working. Like we rarely had a mistake or a pitfall. So everything's going great. So you don't really question it too much. It's like, yeah, I believe it to be true. So therefore it is.
Yeah.
And it turns out to be so. So it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. But then when you are challenged, it kind of does set you back where you go, well, actually, maybe that's worth considering. Am I on the right path here? Should I be doing this? Have they got a point? And you do, I found it really useful because it kind of broke me down, to be honest. So sort of 6 months in, I was seriously questioning what we were doing, if we were on the right path, because you're just getting so much different advice and people saying, yeah, you should try this, or maybe you should do this, or try this over here. And all with the best of intentions, but maybe not with the industry or product knowledge to know exactly what you're doing, I suppose. And so in the end, I kind of got to a point where I go, no, okay, I'm pretty sure I know what I'm doing here. I'm going to build it back up. So they kind of broke it all down. But what happened with that, particularly from an investor point of view, when you start pitching for investment, I knew that business plan inside and out. So it still hasn't happened to this day where I've been in a pitch where someone's asked me a question where I haven't been able to answer it. So you just know the whole thing back to front and you know where the pitfalls are. You know what they're likely going to, you know, where your weak points are that they're going to probably get asked on. So you're going to have a good response for that. You're just really well prepared. So at the time I thought, geez, this is awful. But looking back, it was like almost one of the best things that ever happened, because they really forced you to understand exactly what it is you're doing, why you're doing it, and who you're trying to talk to and who you're trying to target. And that was crucial to it working and being successful from when we launched, I think.
That's a super important point, because early stage founders do get a lot of advice, and you nailed it there. Often 99% of the time with the best of intentions, but maybe not with the knowledge required. So you have to be so, so careful.
You do.
Yeah. Not to go too far the other way, to be belligerent, to go, nah, I'm doing it this way, but not to go too far the other way where they shake your confidence to the point where you're like, oh, we're just going to stop. So I think that's a brilliant, you've summed it up perfectly there, that kind of process of build it down, look at what's on the table, and then pick back up the pieces that you know to be true. That's very important, because logically, like, most businesses don't make sense.
Well, yeah, they probably make sense to two or three people.
On like a balance sheet or on like a business plan, you look at it and go, that doesn't really stand out or make sense.
Well, I would say, to be honest, the balance sheet and the profit and loss and the cash flows, you can make them look as good or as bad as
that's
you
true.
Want.
Off year five, it's like this, yeah, up and to the right.
We'll be doing 100 million in year five, no problem. Like, honestly, it's and you can get too carried away with or too lost in the sauce with that stuff. So for me, it was more about, you know, is there a market? Is there a need? Like, will this thing sell, basically?
Yeah.
And
because they're the only judges that matter are the customers.
Yeah, yeah.
They're the only correct. People at the end of the day can that it, really matter. Market.
And I think the interesting thing about being in Ireland, coming from Australia again, fantastic country, fantastic market, great people, definitely a golf market for sure, but it is only small. So we would estimate we probably have, I don't know, somewhere between 10 and 12% of the total population of Irish golfers have tried seed or continue to try seed already. It's only a small percentage of the world market, really. So you have to build something that can be sold globally. And I think that experience that I mentioned earlier with coming over here and failing kind of made me realize very quickly, look, whatever I do next, it has to have global potential. So it's great to be number one in Ireland, which I'd say we are for direct-to-consumer golf balls easily. But it has to have potential to sell internationally. And that was always in the back of my mind when we were putting it together was, okay, is this a global global play? Like, is it global potential for sales?
I like that. I like that insight because, yeah, we are a small nation. We are really small. Did that factor into what you were building? Because golf balls, someone, I had someone on from a soap company and they were like, I designed it because it was small, it fit through mailboxes. And I was like, wow, that's a really different level of thinking.
Well, you look at... Yeah, 100%. So as I mentioned, it's a consumable. So if you really want to get into the business side of it, the ability logistically to store that product, to ship that product to people cheaply and efficiently is 100% behind it. So we look at a dozen, a box of golf balls, which is only a fairly small package, really easy to ship, store, ship and get to people. And as I said, people use them, they lose them and they need to buy them again. So it's like the perfect product to start a direct-to-consumer
digital
native golf brand with. So
yeah.
That's why we started that.
There's a lot of similarities between that and the soap because he's like, the soap just runs out. You have to buy more. He goes, it literally goes in your hands.
Yeah.
I was like, this is genius. Like, he reminds me a lot of you because very similar D2C setup. He's like, right, I'm going to pick a product. Okay, it's going to be soap. It's going to be this. And like similar trajectory to yourself, like globally. Yeah, he targeted in the US. Like very, very similar. So that was always your mind to be global.
Always, 100%. We got there a lot quicker than I anticipated. And again, the whole island story, being an Aussie, which I didn't realize, just how... You know, like half of America thinks they're Irish in some form.
Oh, it's astronomical. The numbers are hundreds of millions. Like,
yeah.
It's crazy.
It's wild. And what I didn't realize is in all the different corners of the world where the Irish have traveled and gone to. So how we started the business when we launched was using influencers and content creators to essentially review the products for us. So we didn't pay for any of that. We would just get them to review the product for us. And what I didn't expect was the content creation space, YouTube, essentially, is a very broadly distributed medium. It was going far and wide all around the world. So we would have Irish people in, you know, Hong Kong, Singapore, Bahrain, all through Europe and America and Canada particularly, start to pick up the product. So we went from, I thought we'd start in Ireland and then move to the UK. So we might have had like two international markets or, you know, one or two international markets, perhaps in Europe as well. And very quickly we had, I don't know, we got to within 18 months, we had like 20 markets we were dealing to. It was amazing. Wow. And it was really just the power of the art. We were an Irish brand. So in the early days, I didn't speak at all because obviously I'm not Irish and I didn't want to destroy that myth that it's not an Irish product.
This AI software could dub you. We'll give you an Irish accent. Dub you.
Yeah, please, I lived in Cork for a while. I can almost do a Cork accent. So that Irish story, and I would say to a lot of founders here, if they're starting in Ireland, don't underestimate the value of brand Ireland. It is very, very powerful, particularly in golf, I suppose, because I would often describe Ireland, it's not the home of golf, but it's pretty close.
Yeah.
Definitely a bucket list trip for Americans in particular to come over here and play all the, you know, Royal County Downs, Royal Port Rushes, Ballybunion, Lahinches, all those sort of places. As for a small country, you hit above your weight, punch above your weight for the professional level. You know, Rory McIlroy, Shane Lowry, Pori Harrington, Darren Clark, all major champions. Yeah. So it's pretty natural for a golf brand to be based in Ireland, really, is what I'm saying, I suppose. So I think that, and I would often say to people, if I stayed in Australia and tried to do exactly the same thing we've done with Seed down there, I don't think, in fact, I'm sure it wouldn't be successful as it has been. Really? I think that Irish story, yeah, is really part of our whole DNA, the brand DNA, and why people like us. And yeah, I'm a massive fan of Ireland.
Well, I think we'll be opening up you to a whole new market here, because people will be like, wait, one of the best golf balls in the world is designed in Carlo?
Yeah, yeah. In little old Carlo. Who would have thought? And then look, all that stuff I was talking about with using the facilities down there, you know, they weren't put together with the view of when the government or whoever put them together, they weren't thinking, you know what, we could probably make a golf ball down here one day. That wasn't their intention. But we just kind of figured out how to use all those departments to our advantage and what facilities we needed and what activities and engineers and all that sort of stuff, what skills basically we needed and where we could access it. So I was very, right from the early days, I would engage with the colleges really quite actively, probably more so than I should have. They probably were annoying people in the early days. But to find out, could we do this? Hey, what if we do X, Y, Z here? Yeah, we can probably help you with that.
Sometimes the squeaky wheel gets the grease.
I think that's just Australian thing of just, you just go, well, yeah, we'll just go and find out how we just kind of do it, you know? It's, we're going to get it done. So
it's a good attitude. I think you have to, I think Irish people, we can be a wee bit too, sure, whenever.
There's like, no such word as no, I don't think, grand. For an Australian. Like, they probably would say no to me, but I would find a way around it or find a different way to do it, the same thing. So, but look, they've been, Seto's been fantastic. Enterprise Island's been fantastic. So yeah, it's been a great experience through the whole thing, really.
So day one,
uh-huh.
The pallet lands.
Yep.
Talk to me.
Bay One Pallet Land. So we flipped the website up. Really interesting. So another one of the things that Enterprise Island said to me is, look, just MVP, you know, minimal viable product, just get it, just spin up a basic website. The trouble with founders is, and I was the same, you want everything to be perfect. This is your heart and soul. You just spent 2 years putting this thing together. You want everything, every word, every image, every...
Especially when you're building a brand.
Correct.
You weren't just building a product. You had this grand vision for a brand. So it's very easy to kind of go, no, this is everything.
I think in my case, it was definitely a reflection of a lot of things, of what I thought about the golf industry and what I thought a golf brand should be, and... You know, all that type of stuff is tied into it. It's very personal what you're putting out there. So you want it to be perfect because it's a reflection of how you think about mm-hmm. things. And they're like, man, what are you doing? Just get, you don't even know if anybody's going to buy it. Just get a website up there and see what happens. So yeah, we just built this basic, again, through the college, this basic WordPress website, which I thought that'll last us like 6 months. We're going to have to get rid of that. We traded off that for like 3 years, 4 years nearly. Like, it just worked and converted really well. So we just, why change it? Yeah. And so then we just really started, again, just through word of mouth, just kind of, no pun intended, but just kind of seeding the market through people that we knew
okay.
with golf balls and samples. And what would tend to happen with us, we kind of jokingly referred to as marketing, even when we were playing ourselves, if we'd be losing golf balls around the courses all around Ireland, people would find them and they go, this seed thing, I've never heard of that. And they play with it and go, well, that's really good.
Where God, do I should definitely be a brand ambassador. The amount of golf balls yep. I've lost.
You're so,
oh, my Lord.
Yep.
Oh.
So we, you know, they'd find us that way. But what happened, and what we really actively, so for the first 3, maybe 4 years, we didn't advertise market at all. Really unusual for a consumer-driven golf brand. Golf brand's huge marketing industry basically of its own. Like, all those golf brands that you can think of spend a fortune marketing, paying Rory $100 million to play a certain golf ball or wear a certain apparel or whatever.
When I think of golf, I think of like really slick branding, marketing, yep. Nike, you know, really slick marketing campaigns, big budget, you know, when I watch a golf event, like, it's just beautiful.
So that was another interesting conversation with Enterprise Island. So we're going to develop this product for 2 years, and then when we release it, we're not going to advertise it. So that was, yeah.
Yeah, I think I'd scratch my head at that meeting.
What's up with your man?
I'm not sure Dean's okay. Is Dean okay?
He's been down there too long.
Yeah, we need to get him out of Carlo. Yeah, he's gone native.
So one of the things was the whole content creator thing was just starting to emerge at that time. So
what year are we here?
Like 5 years ago, 2018 maybe? Maybe longer, 2018.
7 years, yeah.
Yeah, 7 years ago. Jeez, time gets away. And we were very fortunate. So my whole thing was being a bit of a marketing guy, sales and marketing, branding guy. My whole thing was with those guys to get them interested, you have to, it's like any selling activity. You're looking at who you're trying to talk to and trying to figure out what's important to them. What do they need from you to help you do whatever you want to do? And in our case, it was, what does a content creator need from us to sell our product or promote our product for us? So essentially, we created a content story for them, a really unique one. So that whole thing of not advertising, very unique for a golf brand. The whole thing of not putting a bunch of marketing BS, I suppose, for want of a better term, behind it, not saying, look, it's 10 yards longer than anything that's out there. It's the best product in the world. It's played on tour by Rory or whoever. So we didn't do any of that, which is really, really unusual. So all we would do was when we would send the product to these influencers, content creators, YouTubers, literally send a couple of dozen balls in the mail, like unsolicited, they haven't asked for them,
okay,
with a very simple letter from me, handwritten, saying, hey, we've just developed this thing. This is how we've done it. We've done it here in Colorado University. We think it's really good. How about you tell us, good or bad, you just tell us what you think of it. We'd be really interested to get your opinion. And I think for those guys who are used to getting a bunch of press releases from companies saying exactly that, this is our new golf product. It's 10 yards longer. It's played on tour by these people and it's the best thing ever, which is just a tired old message. They got this unusual thing from this weird guy, Australian in the middle of Ireland, making golf balls, going, wow, that's different. I haven't seen that before.
It's a good hook.
Yeah. And then they would test them.
Was that intentional, Dean, yes, that you weren't doing advertising, that you were kind of going, yes, counter against everything? That was intentional.
100%.
Okay.
Part of the strategy. Yeah, definitely. Well, as I said.
Bold.
Yeah. Well, I just looked at it and thought, well, if we're going to do this properly, if you're going to do that challenger disruption thing, then whatever a normal, you have to be different. So whatever a normal, and that's kind of suits my personality as well. I just don't like the run-of-the-mill normal stuff. So if you're going to, you can't just mimic what everybody else is doing. So we would always say 180 degrees. Whatever a normal golf brand does, we do 180 degrees the opposite. And that was almost like a mantra.
Okay.
So the low key, again, it's kind of my personality, but the low key, no promotion, no oversell, no BS thing, just straight to the point. This is what we want you to do. This is what we think.
It's refreshing.
It is. It's just different. So then when they go and present it, when they're shooting the stuff for their subscribers, it's like, hey, this really unusual thing. You've never heard of it, but it's made at this university, blah, blah, blah. It's a really good story behind it. And then they test it. And what would happen is they'd flash, because everything's computerized, I suppose. There's all like launch monitors, swing monitors that get you all this data now on how stuff performs. So these guys would literally take the number one selling product and go, there's its data on its spin rates and its distance and its peak height and all this sort of technical stuff. And here's the seed. And they get to the end and go, wow, it's pretty much the same. And then so it all took off from there. So I can remember the very first one we got was a guy called Peter Finch over in the UK.
He's huge.
Now one of the biggest influencers. He was just getting started at the same time as well.
How did you identify these people? Because that's very important, I think, is how did you pick?
Just research, really.
Okay.
So just
how many did you do? Can you remember?
Pete was one of the first, definitely. But what happened was once Pete did it, because he had a reputation, he was one of the ones that was starting to break through, then everybody else was like, hey, can I get some of those balls to test? That's a really interesting story. And then it just kind of went from there. We kind of self-fulfilling. So, but yeah, I can remember this distinctly. And there's a few touch points along the way when you're building a brand out that you are, that point you made before, you know, you do kind of have those moments of self-doubt. Is this going to work? You know, we're going to make it. And I can remember that morning after Pete's review came out, flicking open my laptop at home, and there was just all these stream of orders coming in.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, wow.
And so he posted the YouTube video. Was it YouTube
that
or
evening,
what was it?
Yeah, YouTube video that evening. So like a half an hour YouTube video on our product.
Wow, half an hour.
Didn't get massive views, but got like 30,000 views, say, in 24 hours maybe. Anyway, the next morning, as I said, there's all these, and I went down to my wife, she was still in bed, and I said, hey, Lindy, I think we're going to be okay. I think this is going to work, you know? And that was kind of, yeah, you're looking for, always along the way, you're looking for touch points. And then
yeah, I'm fascinated at those little inflection points of companies, because I think we all have them, and it's always trying to pick them out to see what it was. So he posts up the YouTube video. And like, a 30-minute video, like, you're pretty engaged.
Yeah.
If you're going to watch 30 minutes of anything, you're pretty engaged.
Well, you have to get to the end to get the performance data, so you wouldn't purchase it without sitting through that whole thing.
Mm.
So, yeah, it was an in-depth, like it wasn't him just hitting three balls going, yeah, they're okay. Yeah. It was like a proper review. And as I said, then a whole bunch of other people that were trying to get into that content creation space then reached out to us and said, hey, can I get some to test too? And so all of a sudden we went from having one video to having like, I don't know, 10 or 15 in the space of a month, and off it went from there. And as I said, that whole Irish story when people are in Bahrain or Hong Kong or America or wherever, seeing that stuff and then wanting to purchase it as well and get that little touch point of Ireland and help the small guy. So
is that what happened? It kind of seeded out through all these different influencers, content creators, and then the ripple effect of like their followings,
yep,
would buy, and then the Irishness people would start popping up. So
what would happen in the early days, so before we really started advertising, so if you play golf on a Saturday, so again, the touch points I was talking about. So I've worked on a lot of different brands over the years, some really big ones. I've never worked on anything like Seed. So to give you an example of that, so in the early days, we'd get people, say, buying golf balls off us on like a Thursday or something, and then they'd play with them on the weekend, and their mates would be on the tee and they would give away a sleeve, you know, three golf balls to their mates and go, hey, have you heard about these Seed golf balls? You know, they're made in Carlo, whatever. Yeah. And you should try them. And then that we'd get an email on Monday or Tuesday saying, hey, I bought a dozen balls off you last week. I gave them away to my mates on the weekend and I need to get some more off you. And you stop and think about that for a minute and you think, wow, our customers are using their own money to promote our products for us. Like, that is unheard of. So little things like that where you're going, actually, this is kind of working. And so that would happen in America. That would happen everywhere. So you get a few people, maybe not a few, however many it was, you know, you might get 100 people or whatever that would see that video, but then they might tell another two or three people that weekend, and then you get some more orders from there, and then those people tell two or three people, and on it goes. So really,
such a flywheel, isn't it? Yeah, really. So interesting when you think about the process of even playing a game of golf. You're with someone for 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to talk a lot of shit. You're going to talk about literally everything.
Correct.
By the ninth hole, you're like, what are those balls? Well, you just go through everything.
But golfers are really interesting in that they like to be that early adopter thing.
Yeah.
There's guys that like to show their knowledge.
Well, they're gearheads as
correct.
Well.
Correct. And say, hey, have you heard about this? No, you haven't. Oh, well, let me tell you about this then. You don't know anything about it? I
do a lot of running as well now. And like in the gym every week. Yeah. They're like, look at these. Adidas Evo SLs.
Yeah.
And I was like, everyone was like, oh, what are they like? What are they like? You know, because everyone's just, you know, you're into your thing, right? Anything that makes you, with the prospect making you 5% better, you're like, I'm in.
Well, I think it's that thing is exactly right. If and I think for men particularly, if it's like the only thing that they probably have that's their little hobby and their
domain
thing and where they're allowed to spend a reasonable amount of money on. So consequently it opens itself up to that sort of purchase.
And it's an expression of taste as well. I think people are now looking for like,
it is,
you know, this, oh, I'm different. I'm not just, you know, wearing Adidas and Nike. You know, people are now looking for those brands that are a little bit independent, a little bit different, that kind of like, they're just, oh, I found these. Like, there's almost like a buzz of like being the first person to find something new.
And I think as well, the other thing we would get in the early days, we still get it today, but particularly in the early days, was people thanking us. So we would get emails and social messages and stuff saying, thanks for what you're doing. It's fantastic. And
I finally got a birdie.
No, don't be like, man, we're just trying to, like, we're a business at the end of the day. We're trying to sell you golf equipment. But people would appreciate it. And I think there's something really unique or interesting, particularly in the current economic climate where everything is getting much more expensive and cost of living, all that stuff you hear, not just in Ireland, but it's Australia, it's America, it's everywhere.
Hmm.
If you're a company out there trying to do the right thing, so by that I mean giving people a really high quality product but for a fair price, people like that. People will respond to that and appreciate that. And I think you can grow some brand loyalty pretty quickly from that position. It's a pretty nice space to be, I think.
Was it expensive to build up this company?
We very much bootstrapped, so we've kind of done it on a smell of an oily rag. But we did have to raise some capital along the way to make it all happen. So I was very fortunate that met a couple of people in the early days that were pretty significant to making it, you know, giving us the wherewithal, not a huge amount of money by any stretch, but just giving us enough to keep going and get to the next level and expand and grow. And so, as I said, we started with just one golf ball, one design, took 2 years, and now we've got six or seven, I think.
Six, seven balls.
Different design golf balls, of which there's probably different colors, which aren't super difficult to do, but you know, it's probably like, I don't know, 18 SKUs or something in golf balls now. So it's expanded quite a lot, and we've done some other products as well. So you need to be able to continue that development process. You need funding to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you, because anytime I talk to a product manufacturer or someone who's built a product, we had Kaylee from Cash Beauty in recently, and she was like, oh, I developed my first product and then realized I needed to keep developing, developing. Talk me through that process. Like, so you got your first ball.
Mm-hmm.
What was in your head then? You're like, okay, great. One ball is selling. Do you need to keep offering the customer something new, or how does it work?
Yeah, 100%. So it's proof of concept first. So really what you're looking for is A, could we do that thing that I meant? Well, there's three questions we're really trying to answer. Is one, would people believe that story that I just gave you? Would people believe that a small little dinky brand from Carlo could develop a golf ball that plays as well as the market leading products? Like, is that a believable story? Second one was, would people buy from a brand called Seed that they've never heard of? And the third one was really, would they share that story with their friends? And once you start ticking those three boxes, which we did really early on, you kind of go, okay, we're kind of working okay here. So yeah, so we were really looking for those kind of touch points, I suppose, as to where it was that it was being accepted by people, and then when you're looking to expand from there, the first ball we designed is quite broad in its performance specs, meaning whether you're a tour player or someone who's just beginning the game, you'll get on pretty well with that golf ball and it will fit your game. But then if you want to kind of start to drill down a little bit more to that and maybe get something a little bit more tailored to your game, that's when the other products come in. So the three other what we call pro golf balls that we have in the range are just slight variances of that first ball we designed. So one will fly a little lower, one has a little softer feel, one has a little bit more spin. So depending on what you want to look for. So once you get into the seed environment or the seed family, you can really start to dial your performance in and get exactly what you need, and then you don't need to change. You can just use it forever. So that was kind of where we were trying to get to. But you have to prove that first one. So we just started with one, just see if there's a market for it, see if we can get people to use it, see if they like it, see what how the reaction is. And then once we started to do that, then you can expand it out from there. But I would say with D2C, because we tend to go back to the same people all the time, like we'd use email reasonably heavily, you do need, and that thing you just touched on with people liking the bright, shiny new objects, you do need new products to come through to keeping engaged with those people of like, oh, we've got a yellow one now, we've got an orange one, or we've got some new alignment device or whatever we've developed to kind of keep it interesting for them. So yeah, you kind of, if you're in D2C, you're constantly, you don't need to reinvent the wheel all the time, but you need a stream of new products coming through reasonably regularly, maybe once every 6 months, just to keep people engaged and interested in what you're doing. And it works for social and content creation and all that sort of stuff as well.
What's your main channel? Where do you get most of your customers from? Because you talked about it there, it's mainly referral. It was mainly digital influencer content creators at the start. So as you're now more of an established business, so you're 7-8 years old at this
stage? Yeah, 7, I think, yeah.
So, you know, you're getting up on 10 years now, so you're becoming quite an established business. What's your main channel of reaching your customers that works?
We use a few different things. So we don't use Google much at all. So if you're talking customer acquisition, like how do we find new customers?
Yeah.
Hardly use Google, which would be really unusual in our field, I would think. Tend to use a lot of, still use the content creators and influencers, but in a different way. So we would do a lot of sponsorship of specific content series that will match with our brand. So we just did one in the UK with a guy called James Robinson, who's a fairly well-known content creator over there, where he had this series. So every Sunday he would produce a video for us for a year called The Next 100. So rather than playing the top 100 golf courses in the UK, he'd find the next 100 underneath that.
Clever.
And it kind of fits with our branding. So he's trying to find good value experiences where you can still go out and have, you know, a proper golf experience, playing a good golf course, and maybe it's links, maybe it's parkland, but not having to spend $300 to do it.
I like that. That's really smart.
Fits really well with us.
Yeah, love that.
So we do stuff like that, which works really, really well. And those guys, you can't estimate the strength of their relationship with the camera and with the people behind the camera, the viewers. And if they're recommending you genuinely, as long as it's genuine, if it looks as though it's paid for, that doesn't tend to work as well. But if it's genuine, if they genuinely like what you're doing, then they can bring a lot of their subscribers or viewers across with them. So we do a lot of that. Paid digital, we use Meta mainly, which is Facebook and Instagram, which I find fascinating because I don't know anybody that still uses Facebook, but it's still a very powerful tool.
Everybody says that to me. I'm the same. I I don't use Facebook
Trust
at
me.
All.
Same. And I would look at it and think, well, we get more business from Instagram than we do from Facebook. But no, the through paid particularly, 80% of it comes in through Facebook rather than Instagram, which I find fascinating.
So it's always, you have to test your assumptions. Like we talked about earlier, you always have to test your assumptions to see, am I right? Or is that just what I believe?
Yeah, correct. And TikTok's something we're looking at the moment. So we're trying to get TikTok shop up and running. I think there's, you know, it's really interesting in that I keep saying 7 years that we've been doing this. So when I started, those content creators, as I mentioned, were just getting started themselves, similar to ourselves. So there was no pay for play. It was just like send them really every one of those reviews. If you go on YouTube and type in seed golf reviews, there's 100 or more than 100 probably there. And we haven't paid for any of them. It was literally just the cost of product to ship it to them. Whereas now that's the major brands have noticed all this happening and are starting to come into that space. And there's a lot of pay to play. So that's
when you said pay to play, what do you mean?
Well, if I was not necessarily for the reviews, but like that content series we sponsored. So the reviews are great. There's a bit of a timing issue there. So when we release a new product, so say like this year, we just had a new one that was just released. It's a second generation of a ball we've had before. Just won a gold medal over in the States for performance on a thing called a Hot List. It's Golf Digest, which is still a reasonable publication over there, names their best new balls for 2025. Wow. We were on there, got a gold medal, which is great. So they'll do a review on that like right now, but then, okay, what happens next month or the month after and all that type of stuff? And the other thing is if you're not paying for it, you can't really determine when it comes out. So it fits their schedule rather than yours. So what we try and do then is the guys that or the guys and gals that look as though they or have a genuine like for what we're doing. We'll try and partner with them. And that series that I mentioned is how we overcome that and try and develop content that's there all year round.
I love that. That speaks to me because like I do the podcast every week, every year for the last 6 years. And like, I prefer when I can work with people over a long time.
Yeah.
Because it's more authentic. Podcasts are quite passive. Like people are listening to me and you right now. There's going to be people in the gym, people out for a run, people doing like the big weekly shop, you know, and I always ask people whenever they say, oh, listen to the pod, I'm like, where? Tell me how. People listen when they're going to bed.
Yeah.
If you're one of those people listening when you're going to bed, I'd find that very bizarre. A lot of people, I was at a dinner and this guy, it was like a big long dinner with like 10 people. Your man like leaned across, he goes, listen to you last night in bed. And everyone's like, that's an odd opener.
I'm not sure if my voice is really the right tone.
That's what I said. I was like, oh, you're like a nasally Tipperary accent to lull you into sleep talking about business. I was like, that's not something, but it's fascinating, but it's a passive medium. But like that, people listen every single week and the trust is built. I read a great thing. There was a new product of a company I really like launched this week and it got a huge backlash. And someone was posted underneath, like, trust is built in drops and lost in buckets. Very true. So, like, you build week after week, year after year. Whereas, like, I have a lot of creators I follow. And, like, when I know they'll give you an honest review. Even if it is paid, they'll go, look, this is paid, but I'm still going to give you an honest review. And you trust them because you've watched them for years. You have this parasocial relationship with them where you're like, yeah, I've watched Dean for years. Like, he's produced hundreds of these videos. I know he's going to give me a fair steer here because it's not in your best interest. Like I get approached by brands. I'm like, nah, you're okay. Just doesn't tally. If I'm honest, I don't really trust it. I don't see what the uplift will be for people that listen. You know, I don't want a one and done situation. I want something that'll work for years. That's why it's great to work with the sponsor I have now. Like, cause it's over a year. All the sponsors I have now are over for the year. So like it makes total sense. And I think that's what smart brands and companies are doing now. They're not doing the just do two sponsored videos. You're like, yeah, but it's, people's detector of stuff is so high now. And people are like, it's sponsored. Yeah, that's how people make money, lads. There's a style.
You know, you're watching this for free, you know.
I always say that to people, but when people like post like a terrible comment on the TikTok or whatever, I'm like, this is free content, you know. Like, you don't have to pay and you also don't have to comment. Yeah. But like that's the content creation space is so interesting, but I think there is an evolution now and you've obviously hit on it very early in that, you know, take a long-term approach to content. Don't take it. And we talked about it just before we hit record of like, you know, content is quite hard to do it well. It's very difficult. So like to be able to do it over year after year after year, and that's so much more effective because you might watch every one of those top 100, but you might watch 20, 30, 40 and you're like, okay, he's playing with seed. Do you know what? I'm going to give that a crack. I'm going to go play that course and I'm going to get that ball. I'm going to see going to beat his score. Golf is beautiful because it gives you all these different metrics and stuff you can play.
I think as well, how we try and, so anytime we're doing anything like that, we try and not take over the content. So we want to be additive, not taking away from that. So how we'll try and get the content creators, this is kind of like behind the curtain a little bit, but how we try
that's what we're here for.
Yeah, how we try and get them to do that. So say on that particular series we're talking about, if the guy is chipping into a green, maybe he's got a chip over a bunker or something and he needs the ball to check up or stop really quickly, you know, get it to spin. He will generally add something in where, wow, that seed really checked up there. That's amazing. I love that. Oh, you know, it's kind of additive to what he's doing. Yeah. And it doesn't come across as a paid, hey, I'm using the seed SD01 today.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like you're not about to put and go, now, quick word from the sponsor.
So it doesn't take away from the viewing experience.
It doesn't jar.
No, no.
It doesn't jar you out of the, I think that's very important too, especially for long form. So I watch YouTube every day. I think to not jar you out of the, now I've lost the narrative.
Here's
of like
the paid ad.
Kind of. And I don't care. I go, good for you, because obviously I'm in the business, but like I always go, good for you, you get paid. But it's nice when you kind of go, they've thought about this.
Yeah. As long as it's genuine, I think. It's just got to come across as genuine and authentic. And as long as you can achieve that, then I think in that space, like YouTube particularly, I think you're okay.
Yeah.
But it's when it comes across as it's just a commercial relationship that it doesn't really work. That's what we find. So we're very, very much looking for people that have a genuine interest and like of what we're doing. And then we try and work with those people. So
has there been any other major inflection points you point to and go, oh, that was a moment where things really changed?
For us? This is the third year in a row that we've won one of those medals I mentioned in the States. So, probably this one was the first time where I go, well, 3 years in a row, like that's pretty impressive from this little dinky brand from Carlo that we've been able to. And I should say with those reviews that they're doing over there, that's with all the major brands. There's no way of influencing or that decision at all. Like it's completely independent. So yeah, that's definitely been one where you go, yeah, well, I think we're making progress here. Like we're tracking along pretty well. And it's not like, it's interesting with winning. You probably had the same experience when you receive industry medals or awards for things, you kind of think, oh wow, we've made it. Like that's going to be the silver bullet, but it's never quite that way. But it is a slow build up of credibility and validation. And I think at the States, it's almost like a tipping point where it's very difficult. Like the States is our most difficult market to crack. It's just very competitive. It's obviously large in golf because it's high net worth individuals that tend to play golf over there competing against not only golf brands, but luxury brands, you know, Rolex, pharmaceutical companies trying to sell erectile dysfunction medicine and all this sort of stuff.
It's noisy.
It's very noisy.
The States is noisy.
So I think it gets to a point where it's hard to ignore what's going on. It's hard to ignore that there's not some groundswell of support. And we're probably coming at it from a different angle as where most brands would go to America first, build it there, and then take it to the rest of the world. We're kind of building it around in the west of the world and then taking it to the States. So we've had a operation over there for a couple of years. And as I said, just opened one in Australia, which makes four now. So we have an operation here, one in the UK, one in Oz, and one in the US. So yeah, it's very quickly becoming a kind of a global operation, I suppose.
How do you maintain the challenger brand mentality as you become a big brand and become part of the mainstream conversation?
That's a really great question, actually. There's a brand that started at a similar time to us in Germany that does kind of the same thing, more or less. And they've having that experience at the moment. So they did the reverse to us. They went straight to the States and kind of have grown quicker than we have over there. And have just got to the point where they've taken in a lot of VC money and have gone B2B and sort of gone away from the D2C thing. And yeah, they're really, you can see it happening now. They're really struggling with that backlash of, hey, I thought you guys were this and now you're that. You know, you've kind of, you almost become what you hated in a way.
Or was it die young or live long enough to see yourself become the villain?
Correct. Yes. So, and it's a really interesting, and obviously in my position, you're looking at all these different things and what's happening, and you're not just in golf, but in other industries as well. I'd be a very keen observer of what's going on in other industries. So it's an interesting reference point to go, okay, if we ever get to that point, we probably need to be careful of how we manage that situation. Because I think you're 100% correct. Like how do you stay that independent but still be mainstream? That's a very interesting.
It's so interesting because I've seen about a lot of brands, especially in the fitness space. There's one here in Ireland and then there's one in the UK. I think about it as two kind of things I reference, and one of them is Gymshark.
Yeah.
So cool. It was so kind of like the brand. Everyone cool was wearing it. And now it was everywhere. And now it's not cool anymore. And it just like that.
Yeah.
Like literally like that. It just suddenly was like, now it's represent. Now represent is really, really
I haven't
huge.
Heard that one. I'll have to look that up.
It's kind of like it's the new Gymshark. And it was so funny. Like it's so interesting how tastes go. So represent is really kind of popular in kind of like the endurance sports, marathon, high rocks, that kind of style, kind of like high end hybrid athletes. And I was at a high rocks a few weeks ago and it was just like represent everywhere. And this guy turns to me and goes, thank Christ, I didn't buy that represent top during the week. I'm never buying one now.
Oh, really?
And suddenly it had changed.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, it's so quick moving.
So tell me about high rocks. That's like the next version of triathlon kind of thing?
Yeah, it's kind of the new CrossFit kind of triathlon thing. So it's exploded.
Yeah, like, a mate of mine's right from Australia that I used to play golf with, actually. He doesn't play golf anymore and has become, I think he's, and for his age group, I think he's like 2 or 3 in the world or something.
Wow.
Yeah, I think he's pretty high up there.
It's intense. Like people really get into it. Like he really, Ben's doing one at the weekend. I did one 2 weekends ago. It's really like all encompassing because it's kind of like golf is in like, it's quite metrics driven.
Okay.
As in like you can kind of see your scores. You're given a very detailed breakdown. As soon as you go over the line, you're given a breakdown going, this is how long you spent here. And it takes you this length of time and you've crossed the line. Your time is flashed up on the big giant screen.
Happy days.
Very metric based, which is good. Happy days if it's good. Very happy, unhappy days if it's bad. And then you get your photo taken behind this giant screen. They're marketing. Yeah. If you're big into marketing.
So if you're into data and performance, it sounds like you'd be right into it. Okay,
it's,
cool.
It's just, it's so beautifully done in terms of the marketing, in terms of the growth. You're a marketing guy, so you'll love it. Go and look at how, I'll send you a podcast after this of their founder, just how they run their events.
Interesting. I hadn't heard about it. I don't know, maybe 6 or 12 months ago. Now I see it all the time. It's like it's everywhere.
Because there's a couple of magic formula pieces. You'll appreciate, because you made a really good point there about Australia being a 24/7, 365 golf environment and Ireland not. So these guys have got around the fact that, like, you know, marathon is seasonal, triathlon is seasonal. They used to do a lot of cycling events.
Okay.
They're like, it's quite seasonal. So all the events are in giant arenas now.
Gotcha.
So they go all around the world all the time. So Ireland is in November. Like, no way are you putting on a sporting event outside in Ireland in November. But they have the whole RDS. There's a running track in the inside of the RDS.
Okay.
Totally controlled.
So I was wondering if, so the represent thing, I wonder if they saw that, you know, we're talking about markets moving and marketing opportunities moving, if they saw that as a potential growth area and just jumped in early, really.
I don't know for sure, but I would say they did, because a couple of their athletes are HYROX elite athletes, and they live it as well. The George and Tom, who were behind it, like, they live it. They run marathons, they do HYROX, they live the brand, as in they live that lifestyle. So they were, I think, able to, I think to what you said, like your point with the data, I think they could see where brands and things were becoming much more lifestyle driven. You know, people are far more balanced. So on this pod, I talk about the business, the brain and the body, because people are far more lifestyle driven now about, like, I don't want to just work all the time, especially after COVID. People are like, oh, I had a wake up point here.
I think that's an interesting point too, as well, with that thing we were talking about with the big brands, where sometimes it looks unassailable. Sometimes when they are so big, and they, I was had this interesting conversation with, it was actually a female or women's golf publication, like golf website in the UK. And they were really, they were doing a preview or a profile rather on Seed and on myself and all that type of thing. And we were chatting away about advertising and marketing just in general, because I'm just interested in that stuff. And I said, have you seen, you know, there's been a big push towards women getting into golf and trying to support that and all that type of thing. Maybe it's just for appearance more than anything. But she was saying they really struggled to get the major brands to support the publication and the website and the content they were developing, because their marketing manager would say, look, 80% of the market is men, so we need to spend all our market money on that 80%. And I think that's what you're talking about with HYROX, is what creates that opportunity. Is those guys sometimes are so big and so focused on their own little industry that they don't see these, or don't have space to get to some of these new emerging markets. And I think for us, for challenger brands, that's where it's where you need to be, is when stuff's kind of new and moving and different. That's where you can sometimes make hay. And if in that case that takes off really, really quickly, happy days.
You can see it. You're bang on the money there, because I've done it now for just shy of a year. And even last year was different. Like, so it did no gear sponsor for a while.
Right, okay.
And then Puma came in.
Okay.
And Puma were fairly...
Yeah, well known.
Ish. Ish.
That wouldn't be a great fit for that particular activity, I wouldn't think.
Though. Right. So, like,
brand fit, I mean.
You're kind of going, oh, Puma, I can't remember the last time I bought Puma anything.
Yeah.
No, right. And then suddenly, like, the Puma HYROX range is everywhere.
Gotcha.
Everyone is running in Puma, okay. You know, because everyone's like, and then you go in, it's very clever. You'll love it. You should even just go to the one in November just to look at how they've done it. So it's like, it's literally like exit through the gift shop. You come in through the gift shop, you come in through this giant special built store, and then have all their brand partners there. So Built by Athletes, My Protein, Red Bull, they're all there. And it's funny, you've seen them come on over the last year. Oh, now these guys are involved. Now these guys are involved. But it's so interesting to see the challenger brands come in and go, yeah, we'll grab a piece of that. Because you have to.
Yeah.
You know, what makes you...
somewhere.
Well, the big guys either don't see it or take too long to make a decision or don't rate it, don't see the data. I think you're dead right. The challenger brands have to look at these things and go, yeah, like you saying there, but like, we're going to go into TikTok shop now early because there's probably hay to be made there.
Yeah, well, I think there's an opportunity for us in that there's not a huge amount of activity just yet. Like, I'd say the major brands are a little bit wary of TikTok. Should we be in there? Like, what are we supposed to be doing over there? So I think for us, it's a little, there's less headwind to get involved in there. But I think the point you made about the two guys that started HYROX is really interesting, because it's authentic. And I think with us, like, they're authentically into that, that whole activity, that whole space. And I think for golf, I think we're probably a bit the same. I think with my background and... my old man was a golf pro back in Australia, and just kind of growing up in the industry and all that type of stuff. I think it's very authentically golf. So I think people can see that. And yeah, I think if you're trying to, I don't know, pretend to be something that you're not, I think that's difficult to create a lasting brand out of that.
For sure. Where is the next big opportunity for you in golf?
I think the US is really that's kind of like the holy grail, I suppose. It would be for everybody.
Still, even now?
Yeah, I think so. Well, yeah, we're only small over there, definitely. Like, we'd be nowhere near as big. If we could get the same market share over in the States we have here in Ireland, we'd be be laughing. So yeah, so it's a challenging market though. Like it is competitive, and those major brands that I'm talking about, like they're not keen on giving up any of their market share to us for sure. So they're hanging on for as much as they can. And they've definitely, since we've kind of emerged in that newer space and looking at it from a different angle and looking at different marketing opportunities and where, how we can reach golfers in a different way, you know, they, it's taken them a few years, but they've caught up pretty quickly and they're now going, oh, right, okay, we need to be over there and doing some of that stuff. And as I mentioned, instead of what we could have done for, in America particularly, quite economically, is now becoming expensive because they're throwing their weight around. So yeah, so if we can figure out how to crack that market, it's 60% of the world market. Generally, it would lead the global market, meaning if you're big in the States, you're pretty much big everywhere, more or less. So we're, our strategy is a little different. We build it around outside of America and kind of coming from the flanks. So,
what was your thoughts on the LIV Golf?
It's interesting. As an Australian, I have no real issue with it, and it's a bit of a long-winded story, but I can go into it if you like.
That's what we're here for.
We used to have a golf tour back in Australia. So, I mean, like a proper golf tour. So, you'd have 13, 14 events through the summer. And back in the, I'm talking, so my old man was a golf pro, would have played a bit of professional golf, played on the seniors tour over here in Ireland, in Europe when it first got going in the like early 90s. So I spent a bit of time caddying for him as a kid and kind of grew up in that.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was. It was great. He grew up in that environment. But back in the, in those days, so in that sort of, I'm talking late 80s, 90s, even into the zeros. So the US tour would run from kind of March till October. And then it would die off and there'd be nothing really happening from sort of October to March. So Australia had that window where they could run their professional tour in the summer months down there, and they'd get guys like Jack Nicklaus and they'd get Jordan Spieth, and Tiger Woods came down there. That's where he got busted having an affair, I think, before he crashed into the water hydrant. Was he took his mistress to Australia. So I think that was one of those events.
Wow.
So anyway, they used to be able to get people down there to play on the tour. And Greg Norman, who's a bit of a polarizing character now, but would have been the driving force for that. So he was a bit like Tiger Woods of the day. So he would go back to Australia. Obviously, he's an Australian. And he was like the Pied Piper. So he would bring the sponsorship with him. He'd bring the events with him.
And then, he had the name and the contacts. Yeah.
Correct. And all those, but consequently, all those young professionals who I would have played a lot with as a junior had a pathway to becoming a proper professional. So I'm talking Stuart Appleby, Robert Allenby, John Senden, all these guys won on the US tour, but they had this pathway because Greg had created this tour in Australia to allow them to do it. Well, now since the US tour has gone to a 12-month season, that doesn't exist. So that Australian tour is gone.
Wow.
It's still there, but they play from, like we used to have, I don't know, $2 or $3 million tournaments that took them 20, 30 years ago, whereas now they play for 150 grand. So it's still there, but much smaller scale. They've lost all that sponsorship and they can't get anybody to play. So consequently, there's no pathways for young Australian touring professionals to get through. So long-winded way of saying PGA Tour has done nothing for Australian golf down there. And LIV has come in, brought an event down there, which has been hugely popular. They've actually, I heard rumors that they also fund this thing on the Asian tour called the International Series, which is essentially a way of promoting and getting more money into professional golf on the Asian tour. And they had said to the Australian PGA, we will run an international tour series event prior to the LIV Adelaide event and after also. So there'd be three events they'd bring down there for a significant amount of money. And the basically the Australian PGA was told by the US PGA, so I'm led to believe, allegedly, not to take that money because it would be, you know, in breach of their relationships or whatever they had. So they've kind of quashed any growth of that tour. So I look at LIV and think, yeah, I mean, if they're happy to spend money on golf and if it's good for Australian golf and they generate interest down there, then yeah, have at it. And I think the US tour just, the PGA tour I'm talking about just looks at America as the only thing. And LIV is very quickly becoming global, I think, and some of the recent events I've seen, I don't watch much of it, but I've seen a bit of it. Like the one in South Korea was seen popular. There was crowds there. Hong Kong's getting more popular. Singapore's the same. So I think they are slowly, and they spent a lot of money to do it.
They have.
But I think they're slowly building it around, similar to us, I guess, building it around the US, and maybe they'll go back and run four or five events over there if they can.
I think anything that rises the popularity of a sport is a good thing.
Well,
in terms of like bringing
issues, I suppose, with the Saudis and whatnot. But
they wanted, like, it's like, oh no, this is our game. You can't come in and play. Golf can be a bit elitist sometimes. So I think it's anything that brings it more to the masses, I think is good. If it brings more people, like you mentioned there, younger people, females, juniors, if it brings more attention and more players,
That's a bit. Well, I think as well, I think what you find really quickly, not just in golf, but in all industries, a lot of the free market guys, you know, the guys that would say, well, for the free market, are really big on monopolies. Really
Off free market until it's not our market.
It's like Amazon's the same thing. You know, huge on the free market until they control everything. So, I think there's a bit of that with the PGA Tour, as they're very happy to have their monopoly and they don't want any competition. So they're actively trying to stamp that out. So anyway, look. It's an interesting, I think that's why Australians in general would have an ambivalent attitude towards the whole Saudi thing. It's kind of like, well, okay, if they're going to come down and bring the best players in the world and we get to go to an event, we'll be for that.
Yeah.
So I think that's what's happened down there, in my take on that.
Is golf still growing?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it is actually better than ever. So there was a huge boost through COVID. So it was the first sport. That's really when we took off. So I can remember when the lockdowns happened, sitting in my kitchen at home, because we couldn't go to the office, thinking, Jesus, we could be out of business here in 6 weeks. Like, this is not good. No golf courses open. And we sell via subscription as well. So about 30% of our business comes from subscribers. And what was really, again, you're looking for touch points we were talking about earlier. So the subscribers through that period couldn't play golf, but they would still say to us, it's okay, just send me the golf balls. I'll use them when we get back. I know it's helping you guys out at the moment. So just keep them coming.
Wow.
And again, you kind of go, man, that's pretty cool. Like,
that is cool.
That's pretty good. So that was an interesting point as well through that period. And then I think what happened was, if you remember at the time when things opened back up and golf was one of the few sports you could play. And
I was one of those golfers.
Yeah, there you go. And there was a lot of people that were new to golf, but also had maybe played golf as a kid and hadn't played for a while and thought, I'll get back into golf.
Yeah.
That all happened. But I think what happened with us was, there was a big push at the time, I don't really remember, but you'd hear it on the radio and on the news and stuff where people would say, look, don't go to Starbucks for your coffee because they got plenty of money. That's the little mum and pop operations that need your support. So go to the small independent guys.
I remember I started a list during COVID of Irish suppliers. I was like, anyone who's in my community, I want you to pop your name in here. I want you to pop up like what you're doing if you're open. And like, it was just an Excel spreadsheet, but like we had a couple of hundred businesses listed and people could go in and go, oh, I'll support Dean or I'll support Gary or I'll support Ben or whoever it is.
I'm sure that's what happened to us, and that people had heard about us and maybe hadn't tried us, and retail was shut at the time, meaning you couldn't get into a golf shop or something.
Econ so like, went wild.
Try to see golf balls and see what they're like, and then fortunately they're good and they like them and off we went. So yeah, that was, yeah, COVID was really when
did you see a big spike? Because I know Econ went crazy. Did you see a big spike in sales from COVID?
I can't remember the percentage of it, but yes, quite a large jump, and we haven't looked back since then. So I kind of look at Seed, as I said, those first 3 years, 4 years, we traded without it, marketing and everything. So it was really from COVID onwards that we really started to, I feel as we've been a proper business since then. We did a little crowdfunding campaign at the same time, which was really interesting. So I'm always banging on about Seed, particularly to our investors and whatnot, that we develop really or build really brand loyal customers. Because I think, like, you got to look at where you're creating the value. So is it in the brand itself, or is it, and I look at golf and think, so like our first goal was, can we get to 1,000 customers? And then it was like, can we get to 10,000? Then it was like, can we get to 100,000? And now it's like, can we get to 1,000,000? And I think if you've got 1,000,000 customers online that you're talking to via email or social or however, that's very, very valuable, that are really into what you're doing. And then I think, you know, if you're looking for exit and all that sort of stuff for your investors, that becomes valuable, I think, for other larger players who perhaps aren't in the digital space to look at it and go, we need to be in digital. These guys seem to know what they're doing. And golf works that way. That's happened to me twice, where larger companies have acquired skills that they didn't have. So I kind of think the value we build is in that customer acquisition process and also customer retention. So the people that and if I'm banging on about that all the time, about developing these really brand loyal customers and consumers that are really into what we're doing, you know, like Seed, like the product, like the brand story, like the whole idea of premium products for a fair price, all that stuff. The best way to express that is, can you get them to invest their own money in your business? So we ran this crowdfunding campaign just at the end of COVID. Just did it purely by email. So didn't advertise it, didn't market it, built our own crowd. This is before it was regulated. So built our own crowdfunding platform to do it. And raised just a little bit over 350 grand in 24 hours, just purely from our customer base. And that was literally our customers going, hey, we like what you're doing. We want to be part of this story. So we created what we called the Seed Golf Club, so Seed Club, which they became a member of. Obviously, they get discounts off product, but they get invited to events, you know, a whole bunch of kind of come and be part of the community. You know, community is a bit of a buzzword, but it's like, how do you actually execute that? So that was our way of trying to do that. So
that is wild. 350K, 24 hours, purely by email.
To our customer base, nothing else.
Oof.
didn't talk to another soul, wasn't in the Independent, wasn't in the Irish Times, wasn't anywhere.
Traditional media is in trouble.
Traditional media is very much in trouble. And I find it really interesting because we've had a lot of articles now. So we've been in the Irish Times and the Independent and all that stuff. And it definitely has a readership. But we notice, so our golf's really interesting. So a normal consumer would be kind of 50 and over male, predominantly 80% male. Whereas we kind of skew 45 and under is where most of our business comes from. And what we notice is when we're in the traditional press like that, so when we get an article in the paper, which again, 10 years ago, you'd be thinking, wow, if you're in the Irish Times, you kind of made it. Like, this is fantastic news. So you do get business from it, but it tends to be of a older demographic. So it's helpful. It's all validation, but it's not like, yeah, it's nothing like what it was. It's really changed dramatically. So we'd get, I just can't stress how much business we get from those reviews. It's wild, those influencer reviews, both in business and traffic and all that type of stuff.
The huge powerful lesson here is know your customer. Don't assume, don't guess, don't like...
Test. Try.
Experiment, if you will. But it's true, like, because I've chatted with so many founders and they're like, oh, we're trying this, we're trying that, we're trying the other. I was like, yeah, but like, who's your customer? Where are they? Not where you think you are. Where are they really? And you're dead right. Like, you know, traditional media, I was messaging a guy who, he was in the Sunday Times this weekend, and he was on the front page of the business section, and he was like, yeah, we're really dubious about doing it, because like the PR guy was a bit, he wasn't sure. And he was like, look, we got on the front page. And he's like, yeah, but we talked to him for an hour. And, you know, that could have been a cool podcast. I was like, yeah, but there is credibility among a certain readership. Being on the front page of the Sunday Times business section is hugely powerful.
I think if you're looking for investment, definitely.
Bingo. Yep. That's exactly what I said to him. I said, there's a certain demographic, older, probably rich, you know, who only get their news.
High net worth.
I know. True traditional media.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, that's the social proof they need. They can see, they don't see you on TikTok. They don't see you on Instagram.
No, they wouldn't know you exist.
If you see, oh, they did 4 million revenue in Sunday Times. Bingo. They're
definitely
picking up the phone.
I think it's credibility validation. And for that particular audience that you might be talking to, it definitely gives them comfort that, oh, okay, these guys have been recognized by a masthead and therefore it must be legitimate or worthwhile investing in. So yeah, I think it's valuable from, it all has its purpose, but it depends on what you're trying to achieve. And
what did you believe that you've changed your mind on?
What did I believe that I've changed my mind? It's interesting. That whole thing I said about breaking the business down, you know, the business plan, and then putting it back together again. When I put it back to, like, so we were sort of 6 months in and really lost my way, wasn't sure what we should be doing. When I put it all back together, it was pretty much the same as when we started. So a lot of those early assumptions, I don't want to sound like an expert and I knew everything, but to be honest, a lot of the assumptions, and I think that comes from the business experience and the knowledge of the domain. Yeah, it turned out to be true. What I thought would happen is exactly what happened. I didn't expect it to expand globally as quickly as it did, and I didn't expect the consumer reaction to be strong, but I did think there was a market there for it, definitely, yeah.
What do you want, Dean? What's your end goal here?
End goal? For me, it's the creation is the most interesting part of the whole thing. So I think I kind of get a kick out of, so this was just an idea. Like, this didn't exist. It's just an idea in my head that we had that now is a brand that people use and respect and like and enjoy. And there's something really cool about that. So I don't know if you're into that type of, yeah, it's an expression of, I think it's an expression of, a lot of entrepreneurship is an expression of creativity. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs don't necessarily pick up on that. They think it's all about the business and the numbers. And it is, but it can be a little bit more than that. For me, it's definitely more that side of it. I just like building things, you know, and this is like the fourth brand I think I put together myself. Most successful by far. But, and perhaps the early ones were trial runs for how not to do it. They a couple failed miserably. But, yeah, I think it's, yeah, I like the idea of building things, building products and taking something that doesn't exist and putting it out in the world.
There's something beautiful though about taking it. I always say taking it from your brain to your heart to your hands, whereby you actually physically create something new in the world. It's like, it's the closest thing to magic we have, whereby you literally have nothing and then you have a golf ball in your hand. It takes 2 years, but still you have something tangible.
Yeah. And with the brand as well, it's that whole, what does it stand for? What is it about? And as I said, that was really a reflection of what I felt about the industry and how I felt a golf brand should be. And so that, be able to express that in a physical form and have people respond and go, yeah, I think, because they're buying it, so they must agree with that, I think. And as I said, they invested in it also. So that's very rewarding to...
When we're sitting down in 5 years' time to do the next episode of this, what would you love to have happened?
What would I love to have happened? That's a good question. There are many different things. So we're... We're in the throat. We've had some interest at the moment about taking us to an IPO in the States, which is kind of an interesting thing, which I never
Wild.
Thought of would be potentially possible. And that's just really through one of our early investors is really well connected over there in the States. And it's a bit of a long story. But, yeah, there's a bit of interest at the moment about potentially doing that. So I think, yeah, look, if that was to happen, that would be beyond wildest expectations to take this idea we were just talking about to a point where you're standing there at ringing the bell on Wall Street.
That watching the
be,
ticker.
That would be, I would never have envisaged that would have happened, to be honest. So
why not?
Yeah, who knows? Like, who knows? Anything's possible. I'm okay. a big believer in anything's possible.
For sure. Those who believe they can and those who believe they can't are both right.
Ordinary people can do extraordinary things is my mantra. So
love it.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's kind of where we're at. So yeah, so I guess if that was to happen, that would be pretty amazing. And I think just getting to the point where, like, we're almost there now, but getting to a point where it's a respected brand and it's acknowledged in America, I'm talking about, as being one of the, you know, when people talk about golf brands in this space, we're just one of the names that's thrown out as, oh yeah, this Titleist and Callaway and Seed. That would be pretty cool ride as well to have taken it from.
You're part of the lexicon, isn't it? That's the goal for every brand, is to become part of just the lexicon of the industry. Like,
I think once you get to that point, you kind of, there's a few issues in getting to there. Like you were talking about earlier, it was a very valid point of how do you maintain that independence? But yeah, I think once you get to that stage, you're part of the furniture almost.
I think that comes from you. Because I've thought about this a lot. I think that comes from the founder, right? That comes from the founder having the fingerprints still on the brand, because you can always tell when it gets overtaken, the founder gets overtaken or pushed out and it becomes just a big corp run by CEOs and
it's pretty easy
and
to happen.
Consultants. You yeah. know, you can always tell, you're kind of like, it's funny because it's just not cool anymore.
Well, I think it's just expectation. And certainly with the talking about that thing, with the IPO and the investment, you can almost see that that's starting to come into play now, where then there's other people's money involved that require, you know, certain return on that money, yeah. certain events to happen, all that type of stuff. So there's more pressure to do those business type of activities. Not that there isn't now, but that
becomes, when you're on someone else's timeline.
Correct. It becomes more of the focus than, yeah. hey, Dean wants to muck around with some golf equipment.
Outside of business, how do you look after your body and your brain?
Do a bit of cycling. So quite enjoy the cycling. I've had a few issues with my knee. So I went skiing earlier this year and I think I've got arthritis or something and can barely walk. So
that's too related. Did you ever fall?
No, not at all. No, I think it's just like old age, basically. Just arthritis catching up with me and my snowboard. So it's a lot of pressure on the knees when you're doing that stuff. So yeah, do a bit of cycling, get some mates that are interested in that. So we, once a year, we'd go into the Pyrenees and do a few of the Tour de France rides and that type of stuff, which
I
is
like
kind of
that.
Cool. Do a bit of swimming, do a bit of surfing. Always surfed when I was a kid. So took me a while. I must say wetsuit technology has advanced enormously. It took me a while to get into the water.
Surfing in Ireland will make you hardy.
Oh man, it's the best. Honestly, you have some of the best waves in the world. And I don't, well, it's getting known now, but it's, yeah, you got some good breaks. And I'm a bit too old to handle most of them, but there's a few around that I can still get out in.
You're not getting towed up by a jet ski off the coast of Sligo.
No, no, definitely not. Definitely not. But but that's good. And I really enjoy it. I just like being in the ocean and I've kind of got used to the cold water. It's refreshing to be out there now. I kind of find it.
Now, there's bracing. Seasonal activity from March to October.
Well,
it's
always, to be honest, the water temperature doesn't drop much. So it doesn't really make much difference. Some days in winter, you could be out there and it's warmer in the water than standing on the land. So
how do you then mentally, how do you keep kind of sharp, or how do you like maintain that balance between work and play?
I'm pretty, well, that's a good question. I'm pretty family orientated. So that's kind of like always been family first for me. So I suppose one of the things that appealed to me about the online digital business was when my kids were young was to be able to spend the time with them as well. So I kind of wanted to be the guy that could do both, that could do the family thing and build a business around that was substantial. So far it seems to be working okay. It's taken probably longer than perhaps it should have for that reason. But yeah, that kind of keeps you having three daughters, mate. They're very quick to.
What age are they?
They're nine. One's just started up at UCD, 19, 18, 16.
Oh.
So they keep you grounded.
I'd imagine.
And yeah, they don't let you get too far ahead of yourself at all. So yeah, it's good.
You said something beautiful there, and I think there's this notion that you can't do it all, and I disagree with that. I think
I 100% wanted to be the guy that did it all.
Yeah. I think it's nonsense. You get one life and you have to live it on your terms. And I love the fact you said that, like you designed your life around what you really wanted.
Well, I was lucky that when the previous business of this failed, so I kind of had no choice. Like I had to do something else. And I thought at the time, I've probably got one more, I think I've got one more brand in me, and I've got one more play in me to try and do this thing. I think I can do it. It hasn't, I know it hasn't worked out to this point. I'm probably telling you how I explained this to my wife at the time. But I think I've got one more play. I think I can do it, but I just need to rethink it a little bit. And sometimes those failures are very, are great learning experiences if you look at them the right way. Mm. Like you could easily get hard on yourself and think, geez, you're an idiot. Why did you do that? But I think if you actually look back and why did that fail and what did you do wrong and learn from that, I think that can be really valuable. And certainly it wasn't my case. So, so at that time the kids were young and it's kind of like, okay, well, I could go and get a proper corporate job, but that's going to be up in Dublin. I live in Nace. So that's going to be, you know, I don't know, 2 hours a day travel plus the 10 hours a day work. Like that's not going to be great. So yeah, let's have a crack and see if we can get this thing off the ground.
I love that. And patience doesn't have to happen overnight.
Patience, grasshopper. Yeah. Would have been better if it happened overnight, but yeah.
Oh, look, I'd take to be the biggest podcast in the world tomorrow, but I'm on the road, but we'll get there.
But to be fair, if we hadn't taken that time, you know, would it have been as well thought out and well executed as it was? Probably not. Like if you'd rushed it, probably could have got it to market and maybe something would have happened, but maybe it wouldn't have done what it's done.
Easy come, easy go. I think that's a definite trend. You do see sometimes things blow up on TikTok and they don't have the systems and the experience and it blows up. You know, someone talks about it, an influencer suddenly talks about it and it just, they call it like the hug of death. They get like this massive influx of orders and the whole system falls apart.
We've had that happen a couple of times, yeah.
They take on, you touched on it there, take on dumb money. They take on the wrong money. They take on people who push them out of the business like we've seen happen. I think there's a lot to be said for patience, time, decide what you really want, learn from what didn't work in the past. Don't just keep making the same mistakes. Enterprise Ireland helps to support and fund a vibrant startup ecosystem, providing supports, insights and network connections to the most ambitious Irish startups. From expert advice to raising funding, exploring opportunities in international markets to strategic planning, Enterprise Ireland is here to support you in those important startup moments. For more information about how Enterprise Ireland can support you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Enterprise Ireland, helping Irish startups go global. Quick fire round time.
Okay, fire away.
What book should every entrepreneur read?
What book? I'd say that, you know, that point I touched on about the creativity being a big part of the process.
Yep.
There's a book by Rick Rubin called The Creative Act. I don't know if you've come across it.
I haven't read it. I've seen it. It looks really cool. It's grey and it's
very
kind
cool.
Of
some of it's a bit pretentious, I have to say. But the whole idea of it is that creativity is a bigger part of people's lives than perhaps what they give credence to. And I think for entrepreneurs, there's definitely... Certainly for me, it's definitely a creative act. So yeah, I'd recommend Rick's book. Yeah.
What's the most, what price have you paid for your success?
I've probably purposely tried not to pay too heavy a price for it, but I would say setting up a startup like this. So there's 2 years that we've been focused on a couple of times where you give up a lot of earning potential. Mm. So you could look at your peak earning period. So I'm into my 50s now. So 10 years ago, like you're in peak earning period, you could look at it and say, well, I probably could have been earning X if I was doing a proper job. So you definitely pay a price for that. But, you know, perhaps maybe it takes 10 years to get there, but perhaps it all washes out at the end of the day. I certainly wouldn't change anything. I'm very glad I've done what I've done. It's been a few, hasn't been easy. There's been a few times when I would have preferred to have a little bit extra money at various times. But yeah, like we're fine.
There's always that balance in your head going, no, yeah. Just keep with it.
Just keep going.
Keep with it. It's going to work out.
Keep trucking.
Speaking of money, what would you do today if I give you €10 million?
€10 million, man, I'd be up in Donegal in a heartbeat. Oh, you wouldn't see me. I'd be
on a Did beat. Not see that answer coming. I thought you were going to say Brisbane.
No, well, I'd love Donegal. My wife's family used to have a place up there, so we spend a lot of time up there. And I think it's a great part of the world. Fantastic golf courses, great surf beaches. Yeah, I'd be 6 months a year up there and 6 months probably back home.
€10 million Donegal, you're going to be balling out up there. You're going to be the...
It's not about the money. It's the lifestyle. So if I can enjoy my later years and, you know, just walk off into the sunset, I'd be very happy with that.
Nice. And similar question, except I want you to invest in one person. I'm going to give you €1 million. I want you to invest it in one person or one company. Who is it?
If I was pressed, I'd probably say Amazon, to be honest. I think the last stats I saw in the States that 50% of all internet business goes through them. Wow. And it's a monopoly, and we've dabbled with dealing with them, and they're like, I don't like dealing with them, but I have to mad respect. You have to respect the business model.
Don't hate the player, hate the game.
Yeah, it's very impressive business model, and they've got it all covered, and it works brilliantly. And I can't see any way that that's going to change. So, if I had a spare mill, I'd probably just invest it in Jeff and let him do his thing.
Let the player play. If you're starting from zero again in 2025, what would you build?
What would I build? Good question. I think that content stuff we've talked about, I think there's a massive change going on. If it hasn't already happened, it's happening right now in moving from traditional media that we talked about into new media, for want of a better word. So I'd probably build something in the content space and look at how you can, I think how we communicate with people and how we get messages across, which is really valuable. And that's what we've used to grow seed. I think that's probably where I'd focus some attention, because I think in time that's going to be very, very valuable.
What do you believe that other people find weird or strongly disagree with?
I think that point that I mentioned, that you could still have a family life and do this. I think some people struggle with that a little bit. And the other thing I come across a lot talking, particularly in the US with investors, is that capital is more important than labor or the individual or the idea. And I think without people like me to do this sort of stuff, the capital is worthless. Like, it doesn't. And it's just going to sit in a bank somewhere. Like, it needs people like us, like entrepreneurs, to actually go out there and create something with it. So which has more value? I would say the entrepreneur has more value than the actual capital. But people would argue with me about that, depending on who you're talking to.
I would agree with you, but we're biased. What's been your worst investment?
The one prior to this. So I tried to start a golf brand before this, which I think was a better idea personally, but failed miserably. So I might come back to it in some point. But yeah, it... was a girlfriend I tried to start up in hardware, in the traditional B2B market, and just failed miserably. It was a disaster.
Every misstep leads to the right step.
Correct. Here we are online. So that one was in the industry more or less that I was in before. That was before IGO. And opportunity.
What's been your best investment?
This one, seed by far. Yeah, it's been great.
What's your final sentence of advice for every founder or aspiring founder listening? If you can leave them with one piece.
I think I'm a perfect example of, I'm a big believer that ordinary people do extraordinary things, or can do extraordinary things. So that would be my advice to people out there. If you're interested in trying this thing, that you don't have to be, you don't need to be you don't need to be super intelligent or anything like that. You just need the desire and the enough knowledge to be able to make it happen. I think desire gets you a long way. So, ordinary people can achieve extraordinary things.
What a finish. Dean, that was just such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Now, where can people go and order some Seed Golf?
It depends on where you are. But if you go to seedgolf.com, just to our website, you'll be able to find us all there and work away.
Nice. Dean, pleasure.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate you having us on.